I think everyone here agrees that the most important thing in terms of any kind of forced landing where there may be an impact is reducing the total energy. Catherine, if this pilot hears your voice and says, all right, I got to slow down, and they do what's instinctive, they pitch up for a short time, that's going to arrest the descent rate. And it's going to look like, oh my gosh, I just made it worse. I'm going to hit the trees now instead of the field. In that situation, what should they do? Should they just keep bleeding off the speed, and it's like between the trees is more important at low speed than if I hit the grass? Or should they go, nope, better to just get it on the field even a little bit fast than go between the trees and pitch down and take their lumps on the field?
Yeah, this is just a crappy situation. And this pilot could not have put himself really in a worse situation with his prior ineptitude at, you know, trying these emergency landings. So again, were I in this situation, I would do a slip. I would consider, changing some of the configuration of the aircraft. I'm just trying to keep it simple for this pilot. So slowing up the airplane is absolutely what you want to do. And, you know, you're also in uncharted territory because you have a different aircraft configuration that's not going to necessarily act like the book, the way the book says that it's going to glide. So this pilot is going to find out exactly how this plane glides by, you know, slowing it up, and he'll be able to see if he is going to, you know, hit the ground sooner or touch down sooner, I should say, or touch down closer to the tree line. You know, whatever he does, it's better to do so under control. I still think, again, it's important to slow this airplane down, whether that is touching down at a slower airspeed or hitting the trees with a slower airspeed. You know, if I were in that situation and I were still, you know, inexperienced, we've all slipped. I think, you know, if you're going to do a slip, keep it simple. Keep it a small slip. Take it out as you near the ground or the trees. But I think a more experienced pilot could make one of those more Herculean efforts and probably have a better outcome. I just am in favor, given the lack of experience and just the prior terrible performance on these, I just think you need to keep it simple.
Kevin, you're the other one at the table here, so I want to go to you. Would you add anything to that? And again, the same kind of question. This pilot tries to slow down because, oh, I got to slow down. And now it looks like their aim point is the base of the trees. Like, they just made it worse. What should they do?
I like the idea of adding a little bit of distance between me and the trees. And you can't do that in a straight line. But if you make a little bit of an S turn, I think that can buy you a little bit more room. There's not a lot of room for much of an S turn, but even a little bit, I think, is worth trying, just because that could wind up making all the difference in the world.
Dave.
You know, the pilot is a relatively inexperienced pilot, but he's not a potted plant either. You don't want to make a Herculean effort? I disagree. I mean, it's like, this is the time to be Hercules. And this is a desperate situation in which the pilot has just got to figure out a way not to hit the trees at high energy. And really, slipping is the only tool that he has in reach. And so I would think that slip, it's like if you touch down on the wheels, fine. If you want to gear up it, that's okay too. It's just imperative to not hit the trees at high energy. And so anything the pilot can do, do. You got 10 seconds.
So your 2/3, Dave, if I've got you right, is like gear up, gear down, I don't care. Just pick 2 or 3 and slip, lose energy now.
Exactly. The more, I mean, it's like they've got to make contact with the ground with the most distance between that point and the trees. And, you know, I get the point about, FAA flying handbook. You're going to hit the trees, take the energy with the wings. This looks like a thicket of trees. It's like, granted, you've got that big IO-540 battering ram in front of you that will provide some protection, but it's like it's more important to slow down. And the way to slow down is to make contact with the earth. And the sooner the pilot can do that, the better.
Well, I like that you said protection with an airplane that was made in the late 50s in the same sentence, because there's just not much there to absorb the energy. And Colleen, you were like shaking your head about the engine absorbing things. You're also a 2/3. What do you mean by that? Why are you split?
I'm just thinking that engine ending up in my lap is not my ideal situation. You've got a retractable gear airplane. It's going to stop a lot faster without the gear, but the gear will also cushion your landing if you put it down really hard. And I think that the more important thing is to just get to the ground very quickly. I'm a big fan of slips. Sorry this guy's going to learn to slip in his first crash landing in his Comanche, but he's got to do whatever it takes, but still maintain control of the airplane. I mean, game is over if he stalls it in any kind of configuration. So if he can just keep it straight and get it down to the ground and then slow it. I mean, I said 2/3 because I thought maybe we could keep this airplane out of the trees, but I keep looking at this picture and saying, this isn't going to be pretty. So the pilot needs to make that mindset flip, which is really hard, of I'm going to save the airplane, everything's going to be okay, I'm going to go home and have a beer, to this is a train wreck and I need to survive. And whatever it takes to survive, which could possibly include landing in the trees, which has been done, I wouldn't recommend it. But, you know, I mean, there's some crazy things like that. If you can minimize your energy to the point where it's a relatively soft landing, then you're going to walk away. And that's the most important thing.
Well, and that gets to my question that may have been a little difficult to parse in the beginning here of you may end up at a situation, I'm forcing this down into the dirt, or I'm slowing down even more and just not stalling as I hit the trees. If you had to decide, which would it be? David, you've flown in a lot of really remote territory. If you had to decide hitting relatively level ground with more energy or taking a hit into the trees, hopefully between them, with less energy, which would you prioritize?
Absolutely the high energy on the flat field. So the killer accidents are where the airplane deaccelerates rapidly. And so the more distance you have for the deacceleration, the less the G-force, the more survivable. 60 knots to 0 knots is 25 feet at 9 Gs. So one fuselage length. So you don't need a lot to dramatically increase your survivability. The trouble with trees is if you hit a trunk straight on, that's 60 knots to 0 in 3 feet. And that's the killer. One of the things I'd like to add is I don't like forced landing as a descriptor. I think the better descriptor is loss of engine power, controlled crash, because that's what this is. We're not landing, we're crashing. And so the aluminum cocoon that used to be the PA-24-250 is now our lifeboat. And so our goal is to keep it structurally intact. And what the rest of the airplane looks like doesn't matter. Also, I said 2-star because I don't think it's possible to aggressively slip a Comanche because the rudder isn't very big. So I think once you get to full rudder, you're going to have like not a lot of bank. And so I think just putting the rudder over and steering it with the ailerons is going to be pretty simple and will help give you that longer run out. And that extra 50 or 100 feet short can easily make the difference between hitting the trees at, you know, 20 knots or 10 knots versus 50. And, you know, that's the difference between major injury, death, or sore shoulder from the seatbelt. Finally, one option that wasn't discussed is to retract the landing gear after you hit the ground, which I know a person did in almost this exact scenario. After he hit, he just flipped the gear up. The airplane plopped on the ground and skidded to a stop in about 50 feet.
Yeah, I could see over rough ground for sure as it's bumping there. Even the squat switch is eventually, at some point in there, is probably going to turn off and they'll do something, anything better than not, as they try and retract, presuming that they didn't go through the wings. But I could see the slip here being a real issue in terms of control, because as we all know, if you're not really competent with slips, the things people tend to do is the nose tends to drop. They tend to pick up a lot of speed in their slip. worried about that here or not? Wally, you're shaking your head no.
No, I think, the whole deal, as everybody has explained, is getting rid of that speed as quickly as possible, hitting those trees as slow as possible. And an aggressive slip, to me, I would hold it until touchdown. And I'd put that airplane on as soon as I could reasonably get it on and just do everything I could to dissipate the energy. Regards retracting the gear, there's some pros and cons there, I think. Surely it'll stop quicker if you can get that nose gear. But that nose gear is going to come up probably in a Comanche. It probably retracts aft, I think. And so that nose is going to go in. That's going to be a pretty quick stop, but not as quick as hitting a tree, I guess. But there's also the chance that the mains may not come up symmetrically. And if that happens, you're going to ground loop one way or another, which loses the ability to put the airplane between the trees. Because I agree with Catherine, that's the best. If you're going to hit them between the trees. But I would do everything I could, anything you can do to get rid of a knot, which is hanging on to a full slip. And if this pilot doesn't know how to slip, that's to his disadvantage now. But he had an opportunity to learn that when he was checking out in the airplane. So,
you know, one of the things I've heard you say, Dave, if you remember one thing, if the only thing you succeed in doing is not stalling, that's probably the most important thing here. Because the other option here could be pitching up and slowing this thing down so much that it really begins to sink again. And then you probably would come down both very slow and in front of the trees. Good idea, not good idea?
Bad idea.
Why?
Right now, the airplane is in a position at 105 knots and low to the ground. It would be really difficult to stall that airplane before reaching the trees. I don't think that's much of a concern. And it's true that it's like the last thing that the pilot wants to do is lose control before touching down. But I don't think with this much airspeed, even introducing full rudder and cross controls, I don't think there's much of a danger of departure. I think the far greater danger is hitting the trees at high speed.
So they're going to shed that speed. It's happening so quickly, they're not even going to end up in that
exactly.
situation.
Exactly, and just, it's like just get rid of the whatever speed. You can do to scrub off the altitude and as much speed as possible before impact.
David?
I think maybe back up a bit and ask the question of what were we trying to accomplish with this exercise? So we already understood he has difficulty managing the engine off glide. So why isn't he not just at the airport, downwind to beam, throttle to idle, and just practice getting the sight picture?
I couldn't agree more. I think that we've got to treat simulated engine failures as if they were going to become real. And it's like the power off spot landing should be the place to accomplish this, especially for this pilot in this situation. There are so many tragic situations in which a simulated engine out became a real one and ended badly. So, this has all this looks like exactly the same setup. And, to really practice precision and really get a feel for, hitting the mark, over the runway is the right place to do this.
Yeah, I definitely want to broaden this out into practicing engine out. Catherine, you had a comment here.
Yeah, this is this is a scenario that we have to teach as flight instructors. It's a scenario that we have to test as examiners. And it's one of the least realistic things that we do. This airplane right now is probably, 100-ish AGL. I often ask for, I pull the throttle on a practical exam and, where are you going to put it? And they set something up that, is unrealistic. It's often flying, landing with the wind. But I don't get below 500 AGL before I call it off. And so it's anybody's guess. And in my opinion, perhaps we would not have made it. But then how do I prove that? I can't prove that we wouldn't have made it because I could be wrong there, but I have a strong suspicion that we would not have done it. So I couldn't agree more. I have zero idea why on a commercial exam and a flight instructor exam, we do eights on pylons. Those are mandatory maneuvers, but yet the power off 180, I know it's required for commercial. Man, that should be required for private as well. I couldn't agree with you more.
And yeah. I love the idea of practicing them gear up in a retractable airplane. because I just think that's realistic. And as you point out, that sets you up better if the simulated engine out becomes a real one.
But that speaks right to, Dave, the issue and the conundrum here of realistic practice, because a lot of people are going to look at that statement. You're going to practice a 180 to land gear up. So you're telling me you're going to come within, what, 100 feet of the ground knowingly with the gear retracted in an airplane that'll be totaled if for some reason it touches down with the gear retracted in practice? I see the point, but then there's also the counterpoint. And if you're doing this always at an airport, agreed, you're hitting your spot, but there's something so different about when it's grass and trees and that feeling of rush that happens as you get close to the ground, which this pilot experienced. When the trees are closer in, on the trees are closer up front, it's a very different feeling. And an engine that's idling versus an engine that is actually quit, also different. David?
I think again, right back to first principles, what we are trying to accomplish here is judging the glide. Well, lots of things affect the glide. Wind, for example, right? If you have a honking wind, you're going to have a much different flight path than if you don't, or if you have a tailwind. So I don't think the gear up is necessarily required. I think you can learn the same lessons about assessing the airplane's flight path and deviations from the ideal flight path with the gear down. It's seeing that, and that's what I see is with P-180s, we do them in Canada for the commercial, and it's like a cookbook. Like, you know, two parts rudder, one part elevator, turn left at the fork in the road, turn right at the red house, you know, without any actual assessment of the flight path. And if you can do it from the downwind, so now we're doing a curve on the final, if you can assess how the airplane's doing in flight path all the way, then when this happens, you're going to ace it. The last thing, or second thing I'd like to say, which I think is important, Paul Bertarelli looked at engine failures. And basically, 60% of them are caused by the actions or inactions of the pilot. That never gets, or hardly ever gets talked about in flight training, right? When we teach it, we go instantly from a perfect airplane to no power, and the engine doesn't start, right? And then we do all the magic flying. And I know of several accidents where the pilot could have recovered power if they had done a proper flow check. Now, this appears to happen in this one, but before you get to the hero pilot stuff, if you don't absolutely have the actions, like a flow in the cockpit so that you can check all the things that you can fix in the airplane, nailed before you start it, then you're missing the point.
Kevin?
I think that goes very well with the thing that I think should be trained a lot more than is, which is the partial power loss. And there's plenty of times where you don't have the engine power to do what you need to, but well, we're not really convinced that we have a total engine failure either. So maybe you're not doing all those things the way you should be also.
And that partial power loss has been shown to be, is an Australian study, sometimes on the order of 5 times as likely as a full power loss. Colleen.
So I'd like to talk about the fact that this guy is going into the trees. And once he's accepted that and is in self-preservation mode, he's got to do a couple things to make this survivable. He's got to make sure the airplane doesn't come back at the worst possible time, which we don't know why the engine quit. It could be water in the fuel or something like that. I guess that's the assumption. But he's got to shut it off so it doesn't come back right when he's about to enter the tree line. So mags off, you know, fuel off. The fuel off also is critical because he's got a full load of gas in the wings and he's going into the trees, which very, very scary. So he needs to be thinking ahead of the impact.
Wally?
You know, practicing forced landings in an airplane with a big Lycoming engine like that is not easy. The airplane's heavy, it glides fast, it does that. The American Bonanza Society publishes a procedure that starts the simulated forced landing with the gear down and about 17 inches of manifold pressure, which simulates your glide if you were clean, basically. Mm-hmm. Now, that keeps the engine warm. It provides some power. If the engine was quitting, you would hear that happening. So it's warm, it's available to use for the go-around, and then the instructor can adjust the power as the pilot says, okay, I would put my gear down at this point. You could take off a few inches of manifold pressure, and then when the pilot says, I've got it made, I'm going to full flaps, you could close the throttle. And doing this at an airport makes practicing this maneuver really safe. And we've talked about this already, but practicing this out at a field, being new to the airplane, is not the place to do it.
And alone
and
in this
alone,
case, too.
Yeah.
Let me stay with you for a second, Wally. In situations like that, this pilot is being forced to land downwind because that's the situation they put themselves in. They weren't thinking about which way the wind was blowing. They were probably thinking, well, the class delta is behind me, so I'm going that way. Wrong priorities there. So would you practice, for the sake of ultimate safety, forced landings downwind?
I might practice that at an airport, yes.
Okay,
yes,
at an airport.
Sure. But I saw frequently on flight tests that the pilot would not even consider the wind. They got so overloaded with the fact that they have to do the other things. And they would often tell me, well, I can't see any smoke, because somehow they thought, that ended a long time ago, right in the industrial era, where we had smokestacks. But, you know, I would ask them the question, and I've had some of them look at their flight plan to see what the wind was, which was a flight plan at 5,000 feet or something. And I just asked them, which way did you take off 30 minutes ago? And if we took off that way, probably the wind is still about that direction. So why don't you at least select a field in that general direction?
Right. And that comes to that, what I like to say is like cultivating a pervasive awareness of the weather around you. You just kind of want that to be soaking in all the time. Like generally, you know which way the airports are, you know which way the winds are blowing. You've got that mental top-down picture. David, you had something you wanted to say.
Yeah, it's not just the engine that can fail on a low altitude for practice forced approach or forced landing. When I was a private pilot, I was quite a bit heftier than I was now. And my instructor was a big lad. Mm-hmm. And the 150 had a pretty tired engine. Hot day, and he liked to go to 50 feet on these. Guess what happened when I put the power full in? Engine roared to life, flaps didn't budge. And guess what? The airplane didn't climb. And so we spent 3 miles dodging houses and trees at power lines as we struggled up to about 200 feet and got home. So it's not just the engine that can go wrong on your practice forced approach. It's other things too. And so all of this is a bad idea. And I'm with Catherine. I never go below 500 feet. And frankly, as an examiner, at 1,000 feet, I can pretty much tell you how this is going to work. And so usually I will actually stop it at 1,000 feet, especially if it's going well. If it's not, then maybe go a little bit lower just to prove it. But, I mean, all the magic about surviving this starts at the original altitude in terms of setting yourself up for success. If you do that, it's going to work. If you mess that up, then the mistake wasn't at 500 feet, it was at 2,000.
So just backing that up and building on what you said, this pilot, let's suppose they went down to what they thought was about 500, AGL, and that's when they pushed everything forward. And nothing happened. And then there's a couple seconds of disbelief and pushing harder, right? And then the pilot ran a flow to try and restart the airplane. And then the pilot realized that they were 50 feet above the trees and going to hit the ground. Was the flow a bad idea at that point? Was that the lower priority?
Yeah, hands down, 500 feet, you're looking for the best place to land. And, you only address those other things if you can afford the time to do it.
Nods all around the table. Colleen.
Yeah. You've got to kill your disbelief. I mean, you've got to accept that it's going to happen. The flow is you want to be Superman. You want to save this thing. But it's got to be a very quick decision that I've got to give that up.
David.
The flow is now not to restart the engine. It's to shut it down.
Yeah.
And it's the same flow.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that also forces you to make the mental step, right?
Right.
Right. I'm shutting it down, which means I'm landing, which I think is a powerful kind of mental state to make that mind shift. I can't agree more with what Colleen said. I know of an accident where the guy had the field made, flared, and the engine roared back to life, lasted just long enough for him to get to 100 feet, died again, and then went into the trees, survived, but badly injured, airplane wrecked. And he had the field made. If only he'd even just pulled the throttle and done nothing else. You know, and the airplane, it was a good field. The airplane probably wouldn't have even been damaged. But because it roared back to life at the worst possible moment, he went from done, I'm here, I've survived, to a terrible accident.
Wally?
I just wanted to comment about some of these other options. As Catherine and David have seen on flight tests, you see a lot of variations. People try to make something they've had several minutes and several thousand feet to set up and land in a field, and then suddenly they realize this is a bad choice and they're going to do something like some of our other options, which is try to fly over the trees or turn to another field. And those are the ones, if you read the accident reports, those are the ones that usually result in the stall spin and wind up fatal. And this one is not going to be pretty, but at least we'll probably live through it if we can get it slowed down.
Kevin?
If I'm above 500 feet when the engine dies, and I'm already more or less lined up on a field, even if it isn't my best choice of a field, I'm going to do a really quick flow to see if I can get that engine started before I secure it. Because the flow that we're talking about seconds to go through it, just for a few things really quick. And then if that doesn't work, then I totally agree with the securing the engine thing. But if switching tanks or something super easy like that gets the engine back and puts me in a better spot, then I'm going to try to do that.
Colleen?
I was just going to comment. I mean, he's got a lot of speed here. You know, the superhuman thing would be to trade speed for altitude, pop it over the trees and land and be a hero. That would be really cool, but not this pilot. The other thing is that you can't see what's on the other side of the trees. I think I see a house at the end of the field there, and there could be wires, and you could hurt somebody on the ground. I'd rather just hurt myself as opposed to, you know, it's kind of like the door number one, which is, you know, closed, and the, you know, the vacation. It's like, which one do you pick? I'd rather pick what I can see and I know what I'm getting into.
Wally.
Colleen makes a good point about wires. You know, when you're coming into a field straight in, you haven't flown over it, it's hard to see those wires. In the glider world, when we talk about forced landings, we have a saying that just because you don't see wires doesn't mean they're not there. You just haven't found them yet.
Right. And the last thing you want to do is find them with the glider.
Yeah. Exactly. Right.
Yes. There's
so
probably wires.
The moral
near that
is
house.
Never stop looking for the wires on a forced landing.
Right. Although in this case, there's not much you're going to be able to do about it. You're so low, it's just a matter of where you're going to hit them potentially and or whether you're going to force down below them.
Fortunately, this guy's going so fast that he can get through them.
Right. Yeah. Just cut right through. It's no problem. The windmilling prop will take care of that. So I want to go back to one thing Kevin said and ask you, Colleen, because it's probably in your area of expertise. Let's suppose that this was, in fact, water in the fuel. The pilot fueled up the airplane. You know, they waited maybe like 2.5 minutes, sumped both tanks, didn't see any water, off they go. How long would it take to switch tanks and have fuel displace the water that's in the line all the way through the engine? There's a carbureted engine here, so we have a float bowl with a bunch of water in it. I mean, it's not going to be instantaneous, right?
Unfortunately, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, even if you were at, all right, let's make it 1,000 feet. So you had time to run a flow. How long do I wait? Because we never really talk about that. It's not going to happen in a heartbeat unless it was something like a fuel pump failure. You hit the other pump and it starts running again.
Yeah, but you assume it's water, but you really don't know. You don't know how much water you took. The water could have been held up by baffles. It depends on what the internal structure of the tank is. So a little bit of turbulence might have knocked the water down, and it's making its right way to the heart of the matter. I mean, I'm not going to sit there and calculate and wonder what my fuel system looks like. You need to just accept the situation and go with it.
Is it worth waiting, like, you know, giving yourself like a 10 count? Like,
he didn't have a 10 count.
Well, sure.
But yeah, I'm sorry.
But if you backed up, you know, let's suppose we lost the engine at 1,000 feet. Kevin talked about, or it did come back at 1,000 feet, running the flow. And we know we want to secure it before we land. So now there's a gap in there, right? Like, how long am I going to wait for my corrective actions to get this engine relit before I go, nope, because boy, wouldn't it be terrible to pull the mixture, shut off the fuel 1 second before it would have burst back to life because you finally cleared the water. Dave?
Yeah, I would just address that by starting with how long is it going to take me to shut it down and secure it and work back from there? Because it's like that has to be done before touchdown.
So it's more like a below this altitude AGL forget it. That's the point. Like, it hasn't happened by now. It ain't going to happen. I got to secure it. David.
So you do the flow. You wait, you know, a few seconds. The engine comes back. We're now at 700 feet. What guarantee we have the engine's going to keep running? Mm-hmm. I think that only works when you can accept all that, right? And you still are maneuvering for a field, right? So you keep options open. The last thing is I had a situation where an engine failed in a twin Comanche, and switching tanks didn't do anything because it was actually the selector that had failed. And it ran the tank dry, even though the other tank was selected. So there's many causes. So I think this is not the time to experiment. Let's just get the airplane on the ground in a way that will maximize our chance to avoid injury or death.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's part of the takeaway from this whole scenario. You know, when researching it, one of the NTSB reports I came across was of a pilot, similar high performance airplane. They got over the center of a 5,000 foot runway at 300 feet in the air. Fatal. All aboard. Yeah. Because they tried to get it down and lost control of the airplane. Clearly, it's the last couple hundred feet that matter most. And that backs up to saying that practice matters. We have to be able to practice. But on the flip side, we've got to do it in a way that's safe and realistic. And it's worth figuring out the ways to make that happen. Because the whole point of practice is to be ready immediately when that practice situation becomes a reality.